All right, guys, let's go ahead and get started. Thank you for coming to our February RNA Club. Our first speaker is coming from Stanford at the DOS Lab. Her name is Ramya Rangan, and her title today is RNA Structure Landscapes of S. cerevisiae Introns.
Hey, everyone. So I am a fifth year grad student in the DOS Lab, and I'll be telling you a bit today about our work on understanding the structural landscape of introns and yeast. Thank you so much for having me here. It's really exciting to be at one of these and meet everyone here. I think I have to just. Thanks. Cool. So yeah, I'll be talking today about RNA splicing. So as many of you know, this is a relatively ubiquitous post-transcriptional editing process in which large sections of prime RNA, known as introns, are removed from the prime RNA to create final spliced together exon sequences that make up final coding mRNA products. And this process occurs via the recognition of key sequences in the prime RNA, the 5' splice site, the branch point, and the 3' splice site. Now, the process of splicing is facilitated by the action of this large, complex, and highly dynamic macromolecular machine called the spliceosome. I'm pausing the splicing process at the A state, where the U1 SNRP component of the spliceosome interacts with the 5' splice site, and the U2 SNRP component of the spliceosome interacts with the branch point. And then moving through the rest of the stages of this splicing cycle, we'll see the spliceosome undergo more conformational rearrangements as this reaction is carried out. The branch point and the 5' splice site sequence will interact to form this branch lariat conformation. And then the spliceosome goes through more conformational changes, new components start to participate. And these structures have really been visualized by Cryo-EM over the last decade. And then in the second catalytic step of splicing, the 3' splice site is now going to go into the catalytic center, and it's going to create this final spliced mRNA product, which is then released from the spliceosome. So something that we can appreciate looking at the structure is that the substrate of the splicing reaction, this pre-mRNA strand, is probably better conceived rather than just as a linear strand, as a molecule with its own structural ensemble with a mixture of single-stranded regions and base-pairing regions. Now, in this case, this intron, while the regions of the intron that actually interact with the spliceosome were visible in the density of this spliceosome structure, these other regions in the middle are not visualized. We actually don't have data for what this intron structure actually looks like outside the areas that directly interact with the spliceosome. So it's been hypothesized widely that secondary structure in pre-mRNA plays a role in regulating the process of splicing. And yet it's not understood the extent to which structures like this one are present in introns across the board. So there is strong hints in the literature suggesting that secondary structure plays a role in regulating splicing in yeast. And I want to tell you guys about a couple of case studies where people have really identified the role that secondary structure plays in regulating splicing. So one example is these zipper stems that people noted the potential for forming in a bunch of introns, and these connect the 5' splice site and the branch point sequence and allow them to interact potentially more efficiently in the spliceosome. And this has been really nailed down in the case of the intron in RPS17B. There's been a slew of genetics experiments showing the role for a stem that connects UB1 and DB1, the UB1 and DB1 sequences here, which bridges the gap between the 5' splice site and the branch point. And actually the stem is essential for the efficient splicing of this intron. Additionally, the potential for forming stems connecting the branch point and the 3' splice site has been noted, and these stems can reduce the effective distance between these positions and allow them to interact more efficiently in the spliceosome. In fact, a stem in the case of RPS23B between the branch point and the 3' splice site actually hides a cryptic 3' splice site preventing it from being recognized as efficiently by the spliceosome as the canonical spliceosome. So these case studies lead us to the question, what is the prevalence of structural patterns like these and others across introns transcriptome-wide in yeast? And I'll be telling you a bit today about some initial evidence that structures like these are pretty widespread across introns in yeast. And we think that this can hopefully form the basis for some rigorous functional experiments to try to understand what role some of these intron structures are actually playing. So to understand transcriptome-wide, what structural patterns are present in yeast, we first started with some computational prediction approaches, looking at predicted structural ensembles for pre-mRNA in S. cerevisiae along with a bunch of other yeast species. And we looked for structural patterns and motifs that were enriched in pre-mRNA. Additionally, we looked to structure probing experiments as a way to sort of verify the presence of some of these structures. And I'll be focusing today on this latter portion, talking to you a bit about our chemical probing work on yeast introns and the subsequent sort of global analyses of structural patterns, and also the DMS probing for structures that have covariation as a hint for some functional structures. So DMS MAPSeq is an experiment that can provide a glimpse for RNA structures in vivo transcriptome-wide. And the way it works is that you take DMS and you treat your cells with it. It gets into your cells and or into the cells that you're studying, and it chemically modifies accessible positions in RNA. And then these chemical modifications are translated to a sequencing readout. So there are existing DMS MAPSeq datasets for yeast, but when we go look at them, they actually don't have data for most introns. And that's because introns are low abundance in yeast and are spliced relatively efficiently. So we turned to a strain that was developed by Ortiz, a grad student in Manny's lab, and really characterized by him. And this strain sensitizes yeast to splicing inhibition by treatment with plaidenolide B. So essentially when you add plaid B, splicing is paused at that A state with the U1 SNRP and the U2 SNRP. And this chemical actually interacts with a component of the U2 SNRP. So the experiment goes as follows. You take your strain and you treat with plaid B for an hour, and then look at the and then you have an accumulation of pre-mRNA before the first catalytic step of splicing. And then you treat with DMS, which again selectively modifies positions in the RNA that are accessible in solution. And then you go through a bunch of library preparation steps to translate those chemical modifications to mutations in the final sequencing readout. And then you end up getting these reactivity profiles that look like this, where higher values indicate something that was more modified by DMS. So the two ingredients here are mainly plaid B for splicing inhibition and DMS for the structure probing. So here I guess I'm showing some data on the effects of plaid B splicing inhibition on the strain that Ortiz developed. So you can see that there, from these gels, there's an accumulation of pre-mRNA in the conditions with plaid B treatment compared to essentially no visible pre-mRNA band when you don't treat with plaid B. And then from the sequencing readout, you can see the read coverage across introns for various cases. And you're getting a bunch of reads on these intron regions, like here, where before plaid B treatment, which is shown in orange, you essentially had no coverage at all. So this then opens the possibility for analyzing the structure profiles for those introns. Here I'm showing the data for the effects of plaid B treatment for the introns across the genome. So each point here is a different intron, and I'm showing the retained intron fraction before and after plaid B treatment. So you can see that these points are generally above this line, indicating that we have an accumulation of intron reads in the experiment now. So what you're left with then is these reactivity profiles for a bunch of these introns. And you can start by analyzing these reactivity profiles on their own and understand the sort of general patterns of accessibility across introns using these profiles. You can also use these reactivity profiles to make DMS-guided secondary structure predictions. And these use the information from the experiment to make secondary structure predictions. And then you can also assign helix confidence estimates to the helices that come from this prediction. So essentially, these helix confidence estimates come from a confidence estimation approach called bootstrapping, which just randomly resamples the DMS data and makes new structure predictions. Low helix confidence estimates imply that either the DMS data don't support the formation of that helix, or are not informative for the formation of that helix, or that the helix is, you know, not a big portion of that intron structural ensemble. Higher helix confidence estimates have been a useful and stringent sign for the presence of structure. And we use a cutoff of 70% to indicate whether we believe that a helix is, you know, there. So when you look at the correlation between reactivity values between replicates, we can see that we're able to analyze 161 of the reactivity profiles for the introns and their subsequent structure predictions. And this set of introns that is obtained from the experiment is enriched for the class of longer introns in yeast. So these longer introns are introns over the length of 200 nucleotides, and we're getting around 124 of the 138 longer introns in the experiment. And these are introns that are enriched for those in ribosomal protein coding genes in yeast. So going back to this, these sort of structural motifs that have been noted before in terms of these zipper stems and these stems connecting the branch point and the three prime splice site, we were curious, what is the extent to which we can see these from our probing data? So here I'm showing the secondary structures for a few of these examples where we're able to see a zipper stem forming between the five prime splice site and the branch point. So how to read these is I'm basically overlaying the reactivity profiles on top of these secondary structure diagrams. And the more orange positions are positions that are more highly reactive to DMS and are supposed to then be more accessible. And then these values in green indicate helix confidence estimates. And I'm showing in purple here where the five prime splice sites are. And then I'm showing in blue where the branch point sequences are. So what we can see is the formation of these stems that bridge a large gap in the intron sequence that connect these points, the five prime splice site and the branch point. Same in this case, and in this case, the stem here. And these stems are predicted with high helix confidence estimates because they have low reactivity for the DMS modifiable positions, the A's and C's in these stems. And they have more reactive positions in the loops and single-stranded regions. And if we use that cutoff of 70%, we can see that there's 42 of the introns from the data set actually have these zipper stems. Similarly, we can look at the stems that form between the branch point sequence and the three prime splice site sequence. And again, here I'm highlighting in blue where the branch point sequences are, and then in yellow where the three prime splice sites are. And you can see that we can see these stems that form between the branch point and the three prime splice site that again are relatively protected from DMS compared to the surrounding loops and single-stranded regions. And again, if we use that cutoff value of 70% for when we're gonna say this is a real structure, then we see these sorts of stems in 31 of the introns in the data set.
Out of how many?
Out of 160. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that means that, yeah, as we're like resampling the DMS values, like every time we're getting that helix to be there. So yeah, it's a high proportion of the ensemble, but you know, we only do 1,000 samples. So potentially if you did more, it's not gonna be perfect at 100. So I think you wouldn't really see the multiple populations of different structures from this. And for that, we would turn to like approaches like DREAM or DRACO that have been recently developed to like essentially look for multiple structures in these introns. I will say that for the highest coverage introns, I did go through that dream pipeline, and it actually predicted a single structure rather than multiple structures.
And Ramya, for the online audience, could you try to repeat the question? Or
oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, so I was asked about whether if a stem has like 100% helix confidence estimate, whether that means that it's the main member of the ensemble and whether we would see multiple structures from this analysis. Yeah, so then we wanted to ask, you know, beyond those sort of zipper stems and stems between the branch point and the three prime splice site, can we look at the DMS support for other kinds of functional, potentially functional structures? So now we're looking at structures that have covariation. So covariation is a potent signal for a potentially functional structure. And the way this works is you have a sequence alignment, and you're looking for positions or pairs of positions where there are correlated mutations, where the mutations happen such that base pairing is maintained. And that's a signal that this base pair is actually functional and is conserved across the sequence alignment. So we can look for hints for which of these secondary structures are functional by trying to assemble sequence alignments and look for significantly covarying base pairs. So what I did is I went, I used the pipeline that was developed by the Rebos lab and looked at the genomes from the Ascomycete protophylum, which includes yeast. And tried to find introns where there were significantly covariant residues. And what I'm showing you here is all of the introns for which, all of the introns for which there was at least one predicted covariant residue or base pair in a stem of at least three base pairs long. And I'm showing these secondary structure diagrams kind of schematically because these secondary structures tend to be quite large. And I'm showing the regions in green in general where there was at least one covariant base pair. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you look at not quite as distant a related group of yeast, but like the sensory strictly yeast or something that's not quite as wide that you would see additional signals.
Yeah, it's like, it's a good point. Like I think there's actually a nice alignment for all the introns in the Saccharomyces genus. So that would be a nice one to look at too. And I think this kind of stuff is kind of always a balance between like you get high diversity means that you have more potentially signal for these positions, but then these introns are like very sequence divergent pretty quickly. So it's hard to get to the right balance of like you're seeing the signal for the covariant base pairs, but you're not too divergent. So interestingly, introns in yeast harbor, in some cases, snow RNAs, which mediate the modification of rRNA residues. And these are structures that kind of serve as potentially positive controls for this kind of analysis because they're secondary structures that ought to be functional. And Manny actually pointed this out when I was talking about this, but in this list of structures with covariant residues, 7 of the 8 snow RNAs are identified. So that's a kind of good signal that, you know, we're finding structures that have potentially interesting functional roles, either in splicing or some orthogonal process. And the question is, you know, what is the, are these other structures actually formed in cells? And after that, you know, what would they do? So now looking in a bit more detail at the structures that have at least one covariant residue in overlaying that with the DMS reactivity for the structures that were not snow RNAs. Here you can see the positions for these covariant base pairs are shown in green. And again, the DMS reactivity is overlaid. So you can see these stems with higher confidence in the cases of RPS9A, 9B, and RPL7A include these covariant residues. In the case of RPS13, interestingly, even though there's a protection from DMS modification in the stems that contain these covariant base pairs, they actually have lower helix confidence estimates, which means that potentially they don't form as large a portion of the structural ensemble, even though they have a functional role potentially. So in the case of RPS 9A and 9B, actually a functional role for this portion of the intron has been identified. So there's been work to pinpoint this portion of RPS 9A as mediating like an autoregulation loop for the gene expression between 9A and its paralog 9B. So that's one role that this stem here might play. And it'll be interesting to understand whether these other structures have any role in splicing or orthogonal processes in the nucleus. Beyond the structures that I've shown so far, I just wanted to note that the DMS probing data point to extended intron structures in various cases that extend well beyond where the 5' splice site and branch point sequences are, extending with base pairing extending through the full pre-mRNA and including some multi-way junctions. Here's a three-way junction, here's a four-way junction surrounded by some of these higher confidence stems. So we try to measure, you know, how extended are these structures using this measure called maximum ladder distance, which is essentially the longest path length in these secondary structures. And this is just showing the value for the structure is quite large. It's 215, so you have to traverse that long to get from the start of the sequence to, you know, these positions way out here. Additionally, we can model these structures into these the spliceosome structures to kind of understand in general what they sort of look like in the context of the spliceosome. So this is just one potential model for the secondary structure. Or a secondary structure guided 3D model for the intron in RPL 36B. And we can see that the structure extends beyond potentially interaction sites with the U2 SNRP, potentially outside of the spliceosome where it may expose some functional stems that interact with other binding partners or just sort of keep single-stranded nucleotides in the intron from doing something irrelevant that's not good for the splicing process. There's many potential roles for these structures. Another question we wanted to ask is, how do these intron structures compare to the structures of coding mRNA sequences that are primarily cytosolic? So introns had higher distributions or more variable distributions in reactivity profiles compared to coding mRNAs. And this is measured by this metric called the Gini coefficient, which is zero if the reactivity distribution is completely flat, higher values if there's more local variability in reactivity values. So higher Gini coefficients in introns potentially imply that there are more sort of local structures in introns compared to the coding regions, which have more flat reactivity distributions. Additionally, going back to this idea that introns seem to have some of these longer extended structures than coding regions, if you look at this normalized maximum ladder distance, which is a measure for how kind of snake-like this secondary structure is, or how long it extends beyond the positions where it starts, those values are actually higher for introns than in coding regions. Additionally, we can just look at just raw, you know, do introns have longer stems or shorter stems than coding regions? And introns have longer stems overall, and they have stems that have these higher helix confidence estimates than coding regions. So this starts to paint a picture where these introns are potentially more structured or have more extended structures than the coding mRNAs, which are primarily cytosolic. Yeah. Yeah, so the length distributions are definitely different. So there's a bunch of short introns that are much shorter than any of these coding mRNAs are going to be. And then there's this class of longer introns that might get to the same length as these coding regions. So I tried to kind of normalize for that by like length normalizing these numbers basically for the maximum ladder distance, especially because that's obviously gonna depend on how long the sequence actually is.
But many introns in these are coding sequences.
Yeah, exactly. So I think there's a bunch of them that are within the pre-mRNA for these ribosomal protein coding sequences. But for this analysis, I'm just looking at the final mRNAs with those introns spliced out as the sort of coding mRNAs. So just to take a step back, this is sort of the last thing that I wanted to tell you was, like, we can take a look at the introns from this data set across the board. And here I'm showing in each row is a different intron and all the columns, some of which we've talked about and others of which we haven't yet talked about. These are different properties of their secondary structures. You'll recognize some things like the maximum ladder distance here or the delta G stability of the zipper stem in this intron. And we can use these properties to essentially just cluster the introns that we have in our data set. And looking at the classes that pop out, this gives us a sense for how prevalent are some of these features. So like there are roughly 20% of introns that have that stem connecting the branch point and the 3' splice site. And there's roughly 28% of introns that have these zipper stems that connect the 5' splice site and the branch point. There's a bunch of these short introns in the data set that tend to not have longer stems. And then there's the remaining long introns where there are some long stems that don't really fit the criteria of like a zipper stem, but they do have some long stems. And then there's others that are just kind of unstructured across the board. So just to sum up what I've talked about today, so I think introns, it seems like have longer stems and more non-uniform reactivity value distributions and more stable stems potentially than coding regions. The introns tend to have these extended structures that in some cases include covariant residues. And around half of the longer introns in yeast have some of these structural motifs that have been noted in a couple cases before. And you know, when we do these computational analyses on the introns in yeast species beyond S. cerevisiae, we see an enrichment for similar structural motifs across the Saccharomyces genus. So this kind of is implying that maybe these have functional roles in either regulating splicing or doing something else. And obviously the most important next step is to assess what the roles of some of these introns are. So I think building sets of compensatory mutants and doing a variety of assays for these structures is going to be really important and something that I'd love to do next. So yeah, I wanted to thank everyone in my lab, the DOS lab. It's been a really nice place to work with all these wonderful colleagues. And Manny especially has provided a ton of advice through this project and has been like a real cheerleader through the process. So yeah, I just wanted to really thank Manny for his help. And I want to thank Ortiz for the nice conversations. And of course, we're developing this stream that this project is kind of based on. So yeah, happy to take any questions.
So that's amazing amount of structure. It's more structure than the ribosomal RNA.
Yeah.
Very stable.
It was pretty surprising, I think, the extent. I think without, maybe there's less evolutionary pressure in the nucleus to avoid a lot of double-stranded RNA. With the ability to not have to be restricted to the correct coding sequence, you might have the ability to evolve these kind of crazy extended things.
I'm curious, did you see a lot of protected bases that were not in obvious secondary structure? I mean, you might imagine mm-hmm. a lot of tertiary structure.
Yeah, so one thing that, Harry's asking about the presence, the potential presence of tertiary structure from this data. And I think one potential exciting thing would be to try to look for pseudonauts in these structures because they're sort of not able to be predicted by the approaches that we're using. But I mean, if you think about why would someone accidentally evolve a pseudonaut? So it feels like that would be a more potent signal for maybe a functional structure. So I'm working with an intern, Philip, in our group to basically run these predictions, but with pseudonauts included. So to try to look for these signals. And the other aspect of that is that we're now able to do cryo-EM for these RNA structures. So I've also been working to look at sort of segment of one of these introns to try to see whether it forms kind of a stable 3D fold.
Yeah, are you surprised that the intron structures that are not visible in the cryo-EM?
I think if you just put these on cryo-EM grids, you're probably for the most part not going to see much, because these secondary structures are so big and probably pretty flexible that they're not going to really form a compact 3D shape. But I think it would be cool to find some portion that does. So exactly. So there's actually two structures of the spliceosome in, before the first catalytic step, where you can actually see density for an intron stem binding to the U1 SNRF. So this implies that these zipper stem structures might serve a role in addition to bringing together the 5' splice and branch point, might actually increase the binding affinity to the U1 SNRF. Yeah.
Did you look at the prevalence of repetitive or transposable elements as a maybe potential way of doing
I haven't looked at that, but I do know that there's a bunch of cool stuff about human introns and how there's joining of the ends of introns and across the exon boundaries too, because of the ways that transposons integrate. So I think something like that would be a really cool thing to start to do.
Of these secondary structures, because I may be trying to see that architecture. Some type of location spacing on those. So I'm curious about the differences between the human secondary and these.
I think that the potential, I think these sorts of experiments would just need to be done in the human cells, because probably the evolutionary pressures to generate these long structures are pretty different in yeast. I mean, the area on the U1 SNRF where these structures might bind is not even present in the human U1 SNRF. So there's probably some differences there. But in terms of temperature sensitivity, I think you probably already know this, but this paper actually highlighted the fact that this splicing event is actually a temperature sensitive splicing event, because at higher temperatures, the stem unwinds and the earlier 3' splice site is used. So these structures might have different roles in different conditions of stress or different cellular environments. And I think that would be cool to look at. Yeah.
Just following up on that, you can find these different classes, you have one class with the zipper stem. If you look at any one of the classes, is there specific genes or is this pathways to have that? Is there any way you can, the biology?
I should definitely look at that. I mean, I think the one clear thing is that these structures are mostly there in the ribosomal protein coding genes. They're the long class of introns in yeast, but they actually splice really efficiently. So there may be a way in which these structures help with that super highly efficient splicing. So I A kind of sideways way to answer that question is that there's a bunch of sequences in the genome in yeast that look like they ought to splice. Like they have canonical 5' splice sites, bridge points, 3' splice sites. They're transcribed. They wouldn't even mess with NMD, but like they're still not spliced. And I kind of went through and got together a set of decoy introns that was a set that looked like they ought to splice but didn't splice, and compared these structural motifs between the set of canonical introns and those decoys. And these structural motifs could actually be used to classify between those two sets. And the structural patterns are not enriched in those decoys, but are enriched in these standard introns. So it, you know, I don't know about the relationship between these structures and these gene splicing efficiencies, but I think that kind of maybe gets at that question. Yeah.
I'm just curious, with regards to your activity so far, in terms of splicing itself, you observe some sort of pattern in general?
Yeah. I actually, I still have it, but I can show you the. Give me one moment. I think it's in here somewhere. So I basically looked at the reactivity patterns for like meta introns. So if you like collect the set of introns that we have reactivity data for, and as a control used exactly that decoy set that I just talked about. So it's like kind of sequence matched at the 5' splice site, the branch point, and the 3' splice site, and looked to understand whether there's any general patterns in reactivity at these places. And I think in general, the patterns are not super clear, but when you're comparing these sets, you can do the statistical test to find which positions are like significantly different. And the things that I was seeing was that like at the 5' splice site and the branch point, the introns had lower reactivity than those decoys. And this might make sense because we're using PADB to pause splicing at the A state, where the U1 SNRP is binding to the 5' splice site and the U2 SNRP is binding to the branch point. So this might explain like lower reactivity in those positions. Positions external to that, like around the 3' splice site, are actually more accessible in the introns compared to this control. And there's a region upstream of the 3' splice site that's very, that's much more protected in the introns. And this might be like where all the branch points are or where those stems are that connect the branch point and the 3' splice site. Yeah.
So actually, Todd Lowe raised his hand, and you might want to turn your sound on. I think he wants to ask a question.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Thank you. So one of the things that I noticed when I was first looking at the yeast snRNAs that are in introns, they have a lot of extra stem loops compared to functionally equivalent snRNAs and other species. And so perhaps the stem loops, even in the snRNAs, are there for similar reasons that they are in the other parts of the intron. So those might be an interesting place to look, because those might be a little bit easier to study if you had to pick some regions to start making changes.
No, that's a good point. Yeah, maybe I shouldn't just write off all those snRNA.
No, you shouldn't. There's a lot of extra stuff that a lot of people have wondered why there's extra stem loops in there. And it could be for the same reason or similar reasons.
Yeah, no, that would be cool to look at for sure. Yeah. Oh, no, that's a really good point. I don't actually know much about which of the related species do or don't have it, but I think one of the things that people think of when showing all these secondary structures are like microRNA. Is it something related? But yeah, maybe I should take a look at that.
Great. Thanks again, Ramya.
Thank you.
We'll be taking a brief intermission. We'll resume the Zooming stuff in like 15-ish minutes for those of you online. Mm-hmm.